Thank you. Be seated. Good morning. I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad you're here today. We have our second case to be argued this morning, and I understand that the attorneys have checked in and are ready. Before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we begin, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Victor John. I represent the appellant. This is based on crime statistics over the last few decades. Court decisions in this case and the policies nationally and in this state to protect those victims. The National Coalition Against Domestic Violence estimates 40% of Texas women experienced domestic violence. 150 women were killed in Texas in 2019 as a result of domestic violence homicides. The risk of domestic violence homicide increases around 1,000% when that perpetrator has access to a firearm. Furthermore, the Texas Council on Family Violent 100% from 2019 to 2020. And there are some important specifics regarding the acts that abusers take to control the victims and to harm the victims. When an abuser strangles a victim, for instance, they're now 7 times more likely to kill the victim. 43% of homicides had been strangled in the year prior to their death. And 67% of domestic violence homicides used a firearm. The court's purpose, therefore, as stated in Boyd v. Palmore, which is 425 Southwest 425, is to broadly construe the family court's provisions so as to effectuate humanitarian and preventative purposes. It's about listening and trusting domestic violence victims, understanding the complex background and behavior of domestic violence victims that does not apply to other victims of crimes. For instance, carjacking, violence where there's no relationship, burglary. These victims are not questioned regarding their truth to the degree that domestic violence victims are. That's specifically because domestic violence victims behave differently than other victims of crimes. For instance, victims of burglary do not go back to seek out the person who burgled their house. This does not apply to any other crime. But for domestic violence, that is one of the most common features of a domestic violence victim, is that they go back to that abuser because they care for that abuser, because they're in a relationship with that abuser.
Okay, counsel, we have an initial question we need to discuss that deals with our jurisdiction, and that is, in reviewing the record, okay, at the end of the hearing on this particular case, there is a Rule 11 agreement that is entered into by the parties. Both of the parties actually testify to their agreement that it effectively appears to give the exact remedy that Ms. Huskins was looking for by virtue of her petition. It just makes it mutual, that they both have to not communicate with each other, they both not have to contact each other, and that was stated on the record, and it was testified to by both of them. So under those circumstances, why does that not moot her cause of action and her appeal here with regard to us? Because she appears to have effectively gotten the remedy she was seeking in filing her petition, even though it was denied by the directed verdict. As soon as the directed verdict was denied, then the parties entered into what appears to be an all-encompassing mutual injunction against each other so that there won't be any contact and no communication. So why are we not dealing with an issue that really is moot at this point?
Yes, thank you, Justice Birdwell. The reason why the subsequent agreement after the protective order was denied does not moot this this issue is because the power of a protective order is singular and different to any Rule 11 or agreement between the parties.
Well, but there's a judgment entered into based upon, was there not a judgment entered into based upon the Rule 11 agreement? Now, the only reason we're brought to attention to this is because the appellee talked about some other cause of action. So I'm inferring that he filed some type of protective order petition in another cause of action, but the Rule 11 agreement was actually entered into in the reporter's record and in the hearing with regard to your client's petition. So it would be effectuated in her petition. Is there something about the judgment that was entered with regard to her petition that is contrary to what was entered into the judgment with regard to his petition?
Justice, my understanding is that the agreement was entered after the directive verdict was already handed down, and the original petition for the protective order at that time was dismissed, and the Rule 11 agreement was on the other cause of action, that being the other protective order that was filed. And furthermore, to address that point, the Rule 11, although it does give certain legal remedies to my client, to Ms. Huskins, it does not do things like take away the access of firearms of the defendant that was specifically testified to, that he had a firearm. Furthermore, that he would use that firearm and he would harm himself. He threatened my client that he would kill himself if she were to report these incidences of violence. So I would argue that that remedy is inadequate in comparison to the protective order. It's not a remedy that could just have a phone call to the police, for instance. If there's a protective order entered, the police automatically respond, and any contact is a violation of the protective order, not a court process to enforce a Rule 11 agreement. It simply has less strength.
Well, but both of them testified they understood that if, in fact, they violated the agreement and the court's judgment that was entered based upon that agreement, they could be held in contempt. They both testified to that under oath. So, again, why is that not the remedy there? Now, I understand the firearm issue. Ultimately, it looked like the parties resolved it under the circumstances, and we're being asked to give an advisory opinion as opposed to actually decided an ongoing controversy.
And Justice, I would disagree. It's certainly not an advisory opinion, because our position is that the trial court made a mistake by granting that motion for directed verdict, future harm. And still again, I would argue that the fact that although the parties understand that they could be held in contempt should a violation occur, that does not offer the protection that a protective order offers. That is fundamentally different.
But what if it had been, instead of a family violence situation, it had just been a negligence action, and after a directed verdict was granted, the parties entered into a settlement agreement and reduced that to a judgment? Doesn't that moot your complaint that the directed verdict was granted because you've entered into a subsequent settlement agreement involving the same parties and the same claims? And why would this be different? I mean,
the parties' subsequent settlement agreement would bar and moot an appeal process because of that settlement.
And why is it different here, and what authority do you have to quote to us to say that it is different here?
Justice, the difference is the nature and circumstances of this crime and the fact that it was a protective order, which is a very singularly different legal instrument than a settlement action, than the right to have a cause of action for negligence, than the parties giving up rights of appeal. This is an action specifically dealing with the physical safety of the appellant.
Well, I understand the gravity of it, but I don't understand the legal difference between the two. You're resolving an ongoing controversy between the parties at the end of an adverse ruling to one party. And why wouldn't that bar them struggling at And what authority do you have? I understand that it's more serious allegations, but what authority do you have where court says, because it's a more serious allegation, that rule doesn't apply to this case?
Has appealed the entry, the non-entry of a protective order. So unfortunately, I don't have an exact quote case or law that to that point, but I would point to the fact that, of course, the denial of an application for a protective order is a final judgment. That an error in that judgment does give the party a right to an appeal. And I just, again, would have to point the court to the fact that this action, because it has to do with, one, violence and safety as to the applicant, and two, a domestic relationship where the risk factors and the indications are much higher, are extreme. And that makes this a fundamentally different evaluation on how this should be addressed.
Let me throw you a little bit of a lifeline here. Nobody really briefed mootness. Counsel brought it up in his brief as like it was some other type of thing, etc. So these questions are coming from us because when I reviewed the record, I'm looking at what appears to be a Rule 11 agreement that resolves everything between the parties, okay? So if there's a need for the chief's leave for you guys to do some type of post-submission, but one case that y'all need to take a look at is a case called In Re Torres, T-O-R-R-E-S, which deals specifically with protective orders. And the Austin Court of Appeals, it's a 2012 case, and the lady's name is Gabriela Torres. The Austin Court of Appeals dismisses for mootness because after all of the litigation, after the hearing, there was an agreed modified final protective order was entered into after the fact, which effectively mooted everything that had gone before, and that's what the court held. Now, it's a unpublished opinion, but it specifically deals with this issue of mootness, and you do need an opportunity to address it one way or the other. That's a thing that we're concerned about. Moving on, and let's deal with the merits here. You're not saying that his likelihood of future violence was proven conclusively here, because that's a burden. The burden of proof was on your client to establish the likelihood of future violence, correct?
Yes, that's correct, Justice.
So in order for you to be able to have us render a judgment ordering a protective order, we would have to find that there was no evidence to support the trial court's determination of no future evidence, and that there was conclusive evidence of future violence in the record. And you don't make that argument. Your argument is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence here, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So let's assume we find against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence, and I'm going to circle back here, and I hate to use that phrase, but how do we deal with, in terms of entering a judgment here that you favor, how do we deal with the judgment that's been entered based upon the Rule 11 agreement? Without interfering, I mean, without coming up with potentially inconsistent rulings under the circumstances?
Well, first of all, I'd respond and say I would ask for the opportunity to rebrief regarding the issue of mootness. As well, Justice, the reason why it should be found, the trial court judge actually found there was a great wealth of evidence, were her words, finding on the record of an established pattern of domestic violence. And this includes slaps to the face, strikes leaving bruises, strangulations, threats to harm, and sexual violence. The reason is that pattern was what was not considered. That is clearly contrary to the evidence. It establishes a clear pattern, and I'm looking at Clements versus Halosevic, 251 Southwest 3rd 79, finding that an eight-month pattern that was testified to of domestic violence justified future violence, because proving that that pattern.
Past violence, and your time's out, so I'm going to ask the chief for additional time here. You would agree, though, that although future violence can be reasonably inferred from a pattern of past violence, okay, that inference is not a conclusive presumption that has to be drawn by the trial court.
Yes, I would agree, Justice, that it is not required that they find.
But you're arguing here that the pattern was of such nature that the evidence was, that inference should have been in terms of the great weight of the evidence provided.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Niles Illick, and I represent the appellee, Marcus Garcia. You've heard some persuasive policy arguments this morning, but I'm going to argue to the court this morning three legal reasons why this court should affirm the trial court's verdict. As Justice Birdwell has pointed out, perhaps I didn't address mootness thoroughly enough. I may not have even identified it as really the key issue that it is, and I'm happy to address that on post-submission briefing, but I do think the court has hit on an appropriate theme that, especially as Justice Sutterith pointed out, that it's a very clear analogy to the negligence case that hypothetical that she proposed. But if the court can get beyond that, I think that we run into another procedural barrier. And the first procedural barrier that I think that we run into here is that this court, as Justice Birdwell and Justice Sutterith pointed out, resolve this motion on a directed verdict. Now, when I read appellant's brief, I do not see a challenge to a directed verdict. That has a different standard of review, perhaps a more favorable one for him. He has written a legal or factual sufficiency brief. He has not written a brief that goes to the resolution of a directed verdict.
Well, as long as the judgment's entered on the directed verdict, why is it not appropriate in terms of preservation of error to complain about the directed verdict?
Sure.
You're complaining about a judgment that was entered based upon
was
the directed
verdict.
Was a
motion for a new trial filed challenging the sufficiency, factual sufficiency of the evidence?
No, Justice Sutterith, there wasn't one entered. And Justice Birdwell, the case law, I understand the assessment of you're looking at the totality of the evidence, but the case law that governs and the standard of review that governs the entry and the challenge of a directed verdict is simply different case law and different law than would govern the sufficiency of the evidence. And in fact, it's a much more favorable standard of review. Instead of the standard of review you enunciated and discussed earlier, all he would have to say is the trial court erred in granting a directed verdict because there was some evidence that supported a finding of future violence. Therefore, the court should not have entered a directed verdict.
We're not talking about just some evidence. We're talking about uncontradicted testimony from Ms. Huskins about what your client did.
Well,
and to the extent that it was contradicted, it was based upon cross-examination and not any evidence that was presented by your client.
And Justice Birdwell, I acknowledge that, but I suppose the point I was trying to make is that the standard of review and the law for the entry of a judgment based on a directed verdict is different than the entry of a judgment based on, you know, just a normal sort of, there was some evidence on both sides, the court resolves the disputes and rules for one side or the other. That would go to the normal factual sufficiency. But when you get to a directed verdict, the standard is different. So the law is different, and the rules of appellate procedure are fairly clear that if you're going to argue that, if that's what's in the case, that's what you need to argue. He's got to brief that. He's got to make that argument. And in this case, he does not. He does not argue that the trial court erred in granting a directed verdict. And in failing to do that, he's committed a fatal error. The second thing, and I think it goes to what some of Justice Birdwell has just said, is that I think counsel's asking this court to sit as a, well, to make a credibility determination. Now, there's plenty of evidence of domestic violence in the past, and the trial court found that to be credible. And while there were findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case, they were exceedingly short, and they don't say which witnesses were credible, who the trial court believed. And when you look at the evidence here, there was evidence on both sides, and it did come out through cross-examination, but evidence that comes out through cross-examination is not entitled to any less weight or any less significance than direct evidence from my client. So the evidence was that my client moved and lives 8 hours away from her.
Okay, so let me make sure I'm understanding your argument.
Sure.
Okay, you're basically saying that because a directed verdict was based upon no evidence of likely future violence, okay, because a directed verdict is you didn't present any evidence of a particular element, okay? You're actually sort of arguing that the trial court got it wrong and shouldn't have granted the directed verdict even though you moved for it because there was plenty of evidence of past violence which can be used as a reasonable inference of future violence. And so he's complaining that the trial court should have indulged that inference. You're kind of arguing that the trial court should have also indulged that inference and shouldn't have granted the directed verdict, but because he's not complaining specifically about the no evidence ruling, and he's complaining about a judgment based upon against the great weight and preponderance, that somehow he's waived it from a preservation of error standpoint.
And Justice Birdwell, thank you for the opportunity to clarify that, because that's not exactly what I meant to say. First of all, I do think he's waived it by failing to raise the issue of a challenge to the resolution of this case through a directed verdict. Trial court grants a directed verdict, resolves the case on that. You appeal the grant of that directed verdict. I think he has committed waiver there. But I'm not at all saying that the trial court should have denied that motion for directed verdict. The trial court certainly could have denied that, and I think would have been with its prerogative to do so. The problem we have here is that we have conflicting evidence. And we have findings of fact, conclusions of law, but those findings of fact, conclusions of law do not go to who the trial court found credible, whose story the trial court found credible. And as the finder of fact, the trial court was free to believe and really had a duty to find out and decide what stories were true and what stories weren't true. Sitting here looking at a cold record, neither you nor I can put ourselves in the position of that trial court judge and evaluate and assess credibility. So we don't really know what the trial court believed here. The trial court certainly says there was a mountain of evidence in the past, but that doesn't mean that the trial court found that there was significant or any evidence that there would be family violence in the future. And I'm not at all suggesting the trial court should have found that there was a likelihood of family violence in the future. I think the trial court, had it believed the testimony that it was given, could have inferred that, certainly, from the violence in the past. But I think it's wrong, and maybe you touched on it a little bit, Justice Birdwell, to say that simply because there has been domestic violence in the past that you can necessarily automatically infer that there will be domestic violence in the future. And we have factors here that suggest there won't be. Right, he moved 8 hours away. There was a period when the court entered in temporary orders where there was no domestic violence. The appellant herself said she believed the client would follow the court's instruction. The court entered this temporary or this permanent injunction against them.
What relevance or finding of facts on a case that's decided on a directed verdict?
Well, I think Justice Wallach, I think that has real relevance because the trial court remains, it doesn't take away the trial court's role as a finder of fact. And so
if there's a directed verdict, there are no issues of fact.
Well, the trial court, first of all, I would say that's not before the court. I would say that he hasn't raised that as the argument, right? He hasn't argued that the trial court erred in granting a directed verdict.
Your argument is talking about findings of fact, and my question is, what's the relevance to findings of fact if the case is based on a directed verdict?
Well, I understand you telling me that I'm wrong, that there are none, but my understanding of it was that it remains relevant, that the trial court continues to have the role as the fact finder. And if I'm wrong, I'm happy to admit that and say that maybe that argument wasn't the best argument for
my
client.
Don't worry about it. He tells me I'm wrong all the time.
Maybe I'm simply just wrong on that point, and that it is purely a legal matter, and then you look only to the matters of law without looking at credibility, without looking at the findings of fact, conclusions of law, see if there's anything there. Fine. If we do it that way and we take that approach, he still can't prevail. And he still can't prevail because nowhere in his brief does he tell us that the trial court erred for granting a motion for directed verdict. And to Justice Birdwell's point, that really does matter here because the law on addressing the granting of a directed verdict is entirely different than the evidence, sufficiency of the evidence.
But that's
there is
it's a
overlap.
Legal, that's because it's a legal sufficiency standard as opposed to a factual sufficiency standard. Well,
and that's true, but he still had the duty to brief all of that so that I would respond to all of that and that issue would be before the court. But when you don't put that issue before, there's a Venn diagram, right? And there's significant overlap, but it doesn't make them the exact same thing.
Okay, let me ask you something here about, because counsel has brought up a point here with regard to the mootness, that one of the remedies available under the protective Family Violence Protective Order is to remove the Second Amendment rights of the individual
Correct.
Who is the subject of the order, okay? And so that appears to be a unique remedy that I'll have to go back and take a look at the statute with regard to that counsel has brought up that was sought here. So what does that do to your mootness argument if, in fact, the court has the Rule 11 agreement clearly doesn't talk anything about the ability to maintain firearms?
Well, I think that...
And it definitely isn't mutual with regard to both of them, can't sure. or can.
Sure. And Justice Birdwell, I've always looked at this in terms of a permanent mutual injunction much more than a Rule 11. But I think it was their role as the appellant to supplement the record or to file maybe a motion for new trial with that permanent mutual injunction that tells us what was in it for this court to consider. I have no idea what is in that permanent mutual injunction. I don't think this court does, and maybe Mr. John does because he was there.
Well, we have some idea because it was read into the record in this case.
Well, I don't think it was read into the record and complete. I think it was discussed and then entered.
It was specifically represented to be the complete agreement of the parties, and both parties were put on the stand and under oath to confirm that that was their understanding of the agreement, that they could abide by it, and that they understood that if they violated it in any way, that they could be held in contempt by the
and
trial court.
Justice Birdwell, I understand that, but as a former trial court judge, I'm sure you understand that things get added as they go along. So you make the agreement in court. When it comes to putting it on paper, signing it, and getting it filed, it's sometimes a little different by complete agreement, sometimes by instruction from the court. So we needed to see that. But I think...
But if it's on the record in open court, it's a binding agreement, is it not?
It is.
And it doesn't have to be reduced to writing until it's challenged.
It was reduced to writing, and I think we should have seen that. But if we don't...
Do we know that it was reduced to writing? If we don't have it in front of us, can we make the assumption that it was reduced to writing?
I think from the record you can, where it says it's entered in that other cause number. I think
actually it's a family code thing, and the family code permits rulings to be made from the bench as long as they're made on the record. So it can be final from the bench on the record.
My answer is it still is incumbent upon them to show that that is what happened, right? So they can go file a motion for new trial. They can file something to supplement that in the record after the hearing to show either, number one, nothing was filed in the other case and it was all done on the record, or number two, that something was filed and here it is. It's not my job as the appellee to produce the evidence that they need in order to carry their burden. But assuming you're correct,
we can ignore your reference to the agreement in your brief that you don't cite to the record on.
I think the only place that it comes to is from...
That's what you do. You cite it outside the record then, based upon your own argument. You said there was some other deal over here, and we reached an agreement over here, and it's nowhere in the record, and you didn't supplement the record to be able to tell us that, did you?
No, sir, and I don't think it's my responsibility.
Well, it's your responsibility to only talk to us about what's on the record, though.
Well, if I strayed, I have tried.
I'm yanking your chain a little bit because you're telling us basically that it's all his fault when, in fact, you're the one who brought it up, and then you didn't do what you say he's got to do.
And Justice Birdwell, I think it was diligent and my responsibility to bring this up when it wasn't brought up in the original brief. Now, you're perhaps correct that maybe I shouldn't have referenced the other case number, and I'm not trying to pull one over on the court. I'm not trying to pull a fast one. It absolutely was, but you're correct that I don't have a page citation to do that. But I hope you'll see that is a brief prepared in good faith, replete with citations, and no effort to pull one by on the court. But getting back to the court's final question, I think the court's original question that I was talking about, I think we could come back to Justice Sutter's point about the negligence case, that even if all this is true, the parties entered into an agreement. They can give up valuable rights, including the right to have the other person surrender their Second Amendment rights. Resolve it in a Rule 11 agreement. The whole thing is gone. And so I think Justice Sutterith, when I write this post-submission brief, I'm going to be echoing a lot of Justice Sutterith's hypothetical that she posed to Mr. John. So I think that answer would go... my answer would go there. Does that
That's fine.
Answer you? Okay. And then I suppose my last point here is that I do think that ultimately the trial court, if we're going to look at this in a sufficiency standard, made the right determination. And they made the right determination because there was some evidence on our side that future violence would not occur. That evidence was that my client stopped. If you believe he committed the alleged domestic violence, then my client stopped doing that. He moved 8 hours away. There was nothing further. The appellant testified that if the court ordered him to stop contacting her, that he would stop contacting her, and that the court entered that permanent mutual injunction. I think the district court could look at that, make a credibility determination, weigh the evidence, and say, in fact, there is no showing here that there is a likelihood of future family violence. And Justice Wallach, that's where it would go to who they believed, right? That's where you would get the credibility determination.
We can't consider the mutual injunction as evidence supporting the directed verdict because the mutual injunction occurred only after the directed verdict was granted. So the other evidence you're talking about we can consider, but the fact that there was a mutual injunction, that was after the fact, and that's not something that would support the directed verdict.
Okay. Justice Birdwell, I accept that, and I can't change the chronology, but I think to look at it in such a linear fashion detracts from really the messy way that trial courts occur, the way things happen there, and that many things are often going on at the same time.
I know you're addressing three former district judges.
I do, and I'm having a really hard time not calling you Judge Birdwell. I promised myself that I wouldn't call you Judge Birdwell.
He's attributing messiness to district judges.
Well, it is a messier process in my mind down at the appellate, at the trial court, than at the appellate court. There's just a lot more going on.
What's confusing here is the fact that she issued a directed verdict. What you're talking about is if the trial court had in fact exercised a fact-finding function and had found in your client's favor on the issue of future violence, then your argument of what she might could infer from the evidence might support that. So the question is, had this having occurred on a directed verdict, How does that fit in with where we are in this appeal?
And Justice Wallach, that's a terrific question. I really meant to start out with that point, that this came up on a directed verdict. Appellant's brief, for all its elocution and its style, ultimately does not say that the trial court erred in granting a directed verdict, and because of that, have waived the issue, and there's really nothing preserved for an appeal. But if the court decides that I'm wrong, which this court does sometimes, and they say that, in fact, the issue was preserved, and we can go to a factual sufficiency review, then you have to look at it, and you see that there's evidence on both sides. The trial court looked at it. They made the credibility assessment, went in favor of my client.
I understand.
Okay. All right. I have 20 seconds left, so if there are no further questions from the court, I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I thank you for your time, your questions, and your attention, and I'll...
Thank you again. And so the first thing I'd want to address is this issue regarding the directed verdict. I would agree with what Justice Birdwell mentioned, is that, and we would argue that it's not waived, that the issue regarding the directed verdict is not waived, and even if we are applying the factual and legal sufficiency standard, which the appellee argues we should, the evidence is so overwhelming that we would meet that standard as well. I point out specifically that we are discussing the evidence that was presented as to the risk of future violence. There was evidence presented specifically to that. And we certainly believe that the most important part of that was the...
I want to back up for a minute. You have one issue in this case that you briefed, and it is stated, the trial court's denial of appellant's application for protective order is so contrary to the overwhelming weight of the relevant evidence as to be clearly wrong and unjust. That's a factual sufficiency standard. I don't see anything in there where you're teeing up an argument that the trial court erred in granting a directed verdict motion.
And I would agree that, and also with counsel, that that is not mentioned in the brief.
Okay, so you agree you've not challenged the granting of the directed verdict.
That's correct. It is not contained within the brief. I would still argue that it has not been waived, but yes, that is correct.
It's not within the four corners of the brief.
It is not.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Under the legal and factual sufficiency standard, the applicant at the restraining order hearing specifically testified, one, that she was afraid of future harm because of this past violence. Second, much is made of the fact that she said the opposing party would follow court orders. That does not detract from the fear that she had. That shows that the process and the application for protective order was a necessary process to protect her safety. We all hope that the opposing party would follow all orders. That does not mean that the order should not be issued. That means that the order should be issued. I think that cuts both ways and is just as much supporting my argument as it is appellee's. Secondly, as to the credibility determination that was mentioned regarding the witnesses, it was mentioned that we cannot know what the trial court, who they trusted, and we cannot make a determination now on a cold record regarding infer the trustworthiness of their testimony. However, we can infer from those findings of fact that the trial court believed the applicant was telling the truth because she found that the instances of domestic violence that were documented and testified to did indeed occur, as the findings of fact specifically state.
Here's issue with regard to the merits. Okay, let's assume everything that's testified to by your client is absolutely true. Okay, and frankly, there wasn't much other than a little bit of cross-examination to bring that into any doubt. And the trial court clearly believed her with regard to the past, okay? But the trial court has to make a determination of future violence based upon whatever evidence is presented and the trial court, although it may make an inference of future violence based upon a past pattern or practice, and it doesn't even have to be a pattern. It can be just one event in the past. And the law allows the trial court to make that reasonable inference, okay? But whether or not the trial court makes that reasonable inference appears to be an issue of determining the credibility of the evidence. In other words, the court could believe your client, but also believe that the evidence and the time frame and take into consideration the 8 hours away and all of that type of thing, and then decide not to engage in the inference of future violence, okay? Even if your client's afraid of future violence, the test is still going to be a likelihood of future violence. And we ordinarily are not in a position to question a credibility determination in terms of how the evidence is weighed and whether or not the court considers it to be of probative value under those circumstances. So how are we to do that in this instance? How are we to say it wasn't credible to grant the directed verdict here under the circumstances that the court made a credibility determination that no court would have made?
And may I have permission to respond? I see that I'm out of time. Thank you. The determinations that the court made were based on the facts that were presented by the applicant. And those facts are so overwhelming that it was an error not to consider them as part of future violence. And that's the issue that I'm going to. And I've been looking at Del Bosco versus Siebert. That's a unpublished 2012 Westlaw 1795108. In that case, there were 75 days between the alleged violent conduct and the application for a protective order. In this case, there were just under 60 days. The lack of consideration as to the importance and the weight of those actions, specifically future threats to harm the applicant and to harm himself, and the extreme nature of these violent acts, because of that lack of consideration, that's where the issue is.
But you're talking about a case that deals specifically with the court did in fact find there would be a likelihood of future violence, and that was being challenged by the individual who was subject to the injunction. There's not a case, there hasn't been a court that has overruled a trial court that has declined to make the inference that we're talking about here. You're asking us to do something that no other court has ever actually held, that the evidence is so overwhelming that the trial court's credibility determination and weighing of the evidence requires a new trial. You understand that, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been helpful to us. Your case has been submitted, and we're now in recess.
Thank you.